Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, hello, and welcome. Welcome back, should I say, to the Indie Football Podcast. I am Ed Manning, sports editor of The Independent. And on this very busy weekend of football, and busy week indeed of football, I am flanked by two of my most trusty militia. Jack Austin to my right.
Hello, Ed.
Pride of Wales. And to my left, Jonathan Liu.
Hi.
So, pretty spicy weekend of football, all things told. Bit of a, how do we say it, a news bomb dropped on Friday, splattered our entrails all over the web, all over the internet. Then we had Saturday, FA Cup semi-final, Sunday FA Cup semi-final, and then late last night, Napoli reviving the Italian title race in a big way. We'll be talking about all of those today, I guess. And
it's
also
pure football, isn't it? Pure football juice coming out of our ears.
Like, never from concentrate.
Never from concentrate.
No, 100% pure football juice.
Freshly squeezed.
It's bubbling over. We'll also look ahead, by the way, to the Champions League semi-finals, which are this week. And that is real. That's pure football juice. You know, who is it? Real Madrid? No, Bayern Munich against Real Madrid.
Real Madrid on
that
Wednesday.
Is a stonker. And then Liverpool-Roma, the two surprise semi-finalists, let's say. But we'll discuss that later. And we'll discuss that through the medium of Kevin Strootman, who we interviewed exclusively last week, and you can read that on the website. So I want to start with Napoli because I just think it's a great story. And is there anyone with a heart who doesn't support Juventus, who doesn't want Napoli to win Serie A this season?
Well, I think if you don't want Napoli to do it this season, you must have a dustbin for a heart, as they say, as Buffon might.
And he would probably agree with you on this.
Actually, yeah.
He'd probably agree with you on this. The situation is thus. After Kalidou Koulibaly's 90th minute towering header last night, 1-0 win for Napoli in Turin, which is obviously massive. There's great videos on our website of them arriving back in Naples last night and trying to get out of the airport on the team coach, but all the just nutcases in the south of Italy setting off the pyro and stuff. Napoli are now on 84 points, Juve on 85. There are four games to go. But Napoli play Fiorentina away, Torino at home, Sampdoria away, Crotone at home. Juve play Inter away, Bologna at home, Milan at home, Roma away.
What are the chances, by the way, of Torino rolling over?
I like to think Torino might play that game with flip flops on.
I'm not saying that Italian football is inherently acceptable to that kind of thing.
I mean, but isn't the traditional thing, especially they in Argentina, this happens a lot. So like Crotone at home on the final day, like Napoli obviously need to sort that. But in Italian football, you're allowed to offer the bonuses to win. So like Juventus could offer the Crotone players like 100,000 each.
Yeah,
and it certainly happens in Argentine football still.
And a tour of the stadium, something like that.
And Roma at the Olympico on the final day for Juve. I mean, Roma won't have anything to play for. And could
Roma are chasing Champions.
They might have a Champions League final, in which case they might have, might be resting.
It's actually
all
very close for the final Champions League spot as well, because there's only 1 point in it between Lazio, Roma, and Inter.
And they do not want to lose out to Lazio in that chase. But 1 point separates them, and it, you have to say that Napoli have the easier run in. But for me, apart from just making things more interesting, because the super clubs win everything these days. Napoli play some of the best football I've seen in a long time, outside maybe Pep Guardiola's Manchester City. I think they are one of the most elegant teams to watch. So, given that we probably expect them to kind of get stripped down, they might lose the coach, they might lose key players and stuff, do you not feel like this is the win that the Italian league needs?
Yeah, I mean, the sadness, I suppose, is that at that level of European football, which even in Napoli's case is still pretty high in the scheme of things, you get one season. If you have a team like that, if you have a spirit and a manager and a moment like that, you get one season max. And Monaco found that out. Leicester found that out, I guess. And Ajax, I guess, they'll get picked apart in the summer. And so I think it's all the more reason to just kind of enjoy this team and this season while we've still got it.
Yeah, you're right, Jack, about the Champions League chase. I hadn't noticed that. Third and fourth get Champions League. There are three teams separated by 1 point, Roma, Lazio and Inter. Inter currently out of it on 66, Roma and Lazio up there on 67. So Juve have to play Inter, who are in the Champions League chase, Milan, who are desperate for a Europa League spot, they're chasing Atalanta, and Roma, who need the Champions League. Bologna are irrelevant, they're in the mid-table, so that's nothing. Crotone could need to win on the final day to stay up. Almost certainly they will. Otherwise, Sampdoria are probably out of the Europa chase now. Torino have got nothing to play for, so that should be a flip-flops game.
Except banter.
And isn't that the greatest currency of them all? And Fiorentina.
Accepted everywhere.
Pretty much dead. Not to be partisan at all, but I really, really hope Napoli win the win the Italian title, because there's something about Juve.
I think I would have liked to have seen the scenes in the Michael Oliver household when that header went in.
Yeah, well, because, I mean, everyone knows he despises Juventus.
He hates Buffon.
Interestingly, though, I've been Buffon having been rightly, I think, pilloried for the last
There's been some big backlash against him, isn't
there? At full time, he went over to Koulibaly and, you know, gave him a little pat on the head and like had a really heartfelt and sincere conversation. And, you know, he's clearly got a lot of class to him as well, Buffon. So I thought that was a nice and hashtag really nice touch.
Well, maybe he just learnt from the backlash to a situation of significantly less class in virtually the same situation about a week ago. I think if you're looking at the Italian in title race purely as a thing of resources, you know, Napoli do have a rich owner in De Laurentiis, who's staggering amounts of money through Hollywood and stuff. But the kind of way that they cobbled that team together is just so much more interesting. They got some really, for want of a better word, really weird and random players kind of forced together. Players like Marek Hamšík, who have stayed loyal when they didn't need to. And I really like Dries Mertens. It's kind of that little roadrunner style player who just you can't get round. Heisai, the right back, is one of the nicest. And Koulibaly as well, who, remember, Chelsea bid 60-70 million for him last year.
It's interesting to see as well how well the Benitez era players are doing. I mean, Reina is, I wouldn't want to hazard a guess at how old he is, but Reina's still
hanging.
He's got to be
still
mid-30s, isn't he?
Callejon has had a great season.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a team that it's not a single generation of players. It's a team that's been almost kind of accumulated like layers of sedimentary rock and have somehow solidified and calcified into a coherent and really formidable whole.
And Sarri fundamentally is the extreme earth pressure for squeezing them all together.
Yeah, the geothermal force that where is this going?
I'm losing my rock formations pretty quickly. anything else to say on Napoli before? I think, I don't know if you want to do FA Cup next or if you want to do Wenger next.
Well, I'll just say this on Juventus, that the last, was it seven wins in a row? Six wins in a row? Mm-hmm. Six titles? They've rarely faced a challenge like this. They've, I think, won it by an average of 8 to 10 points each time. And it will be really interesting to see how they cope with the pressure. Because, you know, as we alluded to with Buffon, they know the power of a great narrative. And really, the kind of the force of narrative is very much with Napoli at the moment.
Well, three of their four fixtures are bloody difficult. And they've got Real Madrid twice in the same period. And potentially a Champions League final if they get by Real Madrid. So, no, they haven't. Bayern Munich, sorry.
The Real Madrid thing happened.
Yes, yeah, that would be in the past. That would be a thing that already occurred. Okay, fine.
Cut that.
FA Cup. No, we don't cut anything here because we like to be honest and transparent. That's why I admitted that we screwed up the recording last week. FA Cup semi-finals. You were at the first one.
The second one. Chelsea-Southampton yesterday.
Chelsea-Southampton, where we saw Antonio Conte's team win comfortably.
Yeah.
Southampton didn't put up as much of a...
There were a couple of moments, I guess, when Southampton could have found a toehold back into the game, but Chelsea would just had a little bit of an extra gear. And I think from the moment they went ahead and Southampton had to chase the game, which they hadn't really set themselves up to do, I think it was pretty much of a foregone conclusion.
And we talked... a lot of the kind of... The immediate reaction to this was, okay, so we've got the Conte-Mourinho final. So this, Jack, is a final where you've got Conte's final game, basically. We all expect it to be his final game in charge of Chelsea, although I think they've got to be looking at their options now and being kind of, do we get rid of him? But if you assume it's Conte versus Mourinho, final game, Conte and Mourinho don't like each other. Both of these teams kind of need a trophy to make this season less of a failure. I don't know even if either would categorise it as a success, just winning the FA Cup, but this final has at least something to it.
Yeah, well, Mourinho said that his focus was still finishing second in the league, but I don't believe that. He's a trophy man. He wants to win trophies, and for him, it's a failure if he doesn't get his hands on a trophy. You see, by the way, he always prioritises the League Cup. He always wants something to show that he's been successful for that season.
He hates talking about his successes.
He does, yeah. Very modest man.
Yes.
Again, with Conte, he doesn't want his final season, his final game at Chelsea to be a negative season. He wants it to end on a high. They're not going to get Champions League, but an FA Cup win, get the fans behind him.
And part of this, this thing about Mourinho is like a big trophy guy, has been, for want of a better word, transposed onto Mauricio Pochettino, because Man United beat Spurs 2-1 on Saturday in a game that certainly, so Jack Pitbrook, who covers Spurs for us regularly, described it as basically a bottle job by Tottenham. And you're looking at that team and for all the progress Spurs have made under Pochettino, which is enormous, and I think over the last 3 or 4 years, they've probably been the second best team in England. But they're not winning anything. It's becoming kind of a stick to beat Pochettino with. And then Pochettino, after the game, suggesting perhaps that he might not stick around to see the next phase. So, Johnny, what do you make of the Spurs situation with regards to all this?
Well, as someone who's watched Spurs quite a lot over the last 2 or 3 years, I didn't actually find anything in Saturday's game that surprised me. They have a real problem, I think, with defending for long periods of time against elite-level sides. We saw it at home against Chelsea, but all the way back in August. We saw it against Juventus. We saw it twice against Manchester City. That their entire setup is almost predicated on the need for not having to defend. And when they have to defend for long periods, they're brittle and they concede. And they concede goals far too easily. I think whether that's the definition of bottling it or whether that's due to some mental frailty, I don't know. That's a debate for another time. But I think it's probably a debate for 2 or 3 minutes' time. But but I think that's something that really needs to be addressed, because it felt inevitable from when United equalised that Tottenham's defence would not be able to cope with successive waves of United pressure.
Do you think... is it worrying that, because fundamentally, I think a lot of people now they probably place Pochettino on a higher plane than Jose Mourinho in terms of a coach that you'd want for your club. But I did feel that this was a game where I think just Mourinho got it right. I think he played around and found the weaknesses in that Tottenham team. And I think a lot of it does come down to if you can just put them under pressure. But do we believe that Pochettino being exposed in these big games, I think a lot of the narrative that's come out of it is, what do Spurs have to do to take the next step? Now, does that equate with just him being outthought in a one-off game at Wembley, or do you subscribe to the idea that it is a greater issue at hand, a larger problem with the club?
Well, I have to say that I did disagree slightly with Jack's piece, where he said that Spurs were clearly better and gave it away. I thought Spurs were definitely better in the first 20 minutes, but if you look man for man, the talent in that United team is actually at least on a par with the talent in that Spurs team. What has elevated Spurs over the last few years is the ability to become more than the sum of their parts. When they are just their parts, and I do admit that for parts of the second half, that's all they were. They are made to look quite ordinary. And look, if you think about the talent in that United side, Pogba, Sanchez, Lukaku, all combining for that, you know, for that first goal, it's slightly underselling United, I think, to say that they were an inferior team who basically preyed on a mentally weaker rival.
One of the big problems United have had in recent weeks, Jack, is that they've got all the big names on, shed loads of cash, Pogba, Sanchez and stuff, and they're not performing. This was almost like the perfect narrative game for Mourinho, in that all of his big names, his big guys, came up in the right moment, right?
Yeah, I think the way that they pay their players is almost the antithesis of what Spurs do, in the sense that they're paying the big wages, getting the big names, whereas Spurs are building a team together and they've almost got a feeling of togetherness as opposed to a team of individuals. But what I think that on the weekend, almost United showed more of a feel of togetherness, in the sense that Mourinho isn't afraid to come out and say he wants to win, and he wanted to win that FA Cup semi-final. His players wanted to win, whereas Pochettino came out and was like, not that fussed on the FA Cup. It's not a big deal for me. But if you ask any one of those Spurs players if they want to win the FA Cup, hell yeah, of course they will.
I kind of like Poch's tactic of mugging off the FA Cup at every opportunity, because then if you just happen to win it, then you're like, oh yeah, well, I'm glad we won, but we
don't. Oh, that old thing.
Yeah, like, not that bothered. And I guess in some way it does relieve the pressure on the players. It's, you know, you're not forcing them into it. But at some point, there is an expectation of victory when you're spending this much money and you're playing this well, right?
Yeah. I'd slightly disagree with that. I think that if you're a player and your manager's going out week in, week out, saying, we don't want this, not important, we don't want to win it, and then after going out saying, next season I'll probably just play the kids. Like, a lot of these players haven't got any silverware. They haven't won any medals. And they're, with the way Man City are playing, they're unlikely to win the Premier League or the Champions League. This is almost one of their best opportunities to win a trophy. And when your manager's coming out and saying, oh, I'm not that fussed, I'm not sure that is exactly what the players want to hear.
I suspect he was saying something quite different in private. And I think... Mm.
But is that not mixed messages?
Yeah, possibly. But I think he's going into that dressing room and saying, look, I'm trying to take the pressure off you in public, but everybody knows, fans know, the players know just how important it was to win that semi-final. I mean, there's no getting around that, really. And the fact that they didn't turn up will be just sickening for a lot of them.
Yeah.
Do we... if you're looking at Spurs, I'm going to get Jack Pitbrook to write more fully about this probably tomorrow, but everyone's saying that, you know, Spurs need to kick on to the next level. They need to win a trophy. They need to kind of step up. And a lot of the focus is on Daniel Levy to invest more, because fundamentally all of their top players are underpaid in terms of market value. They're not a team that goes out and spends massive money on players. They only tend to go in the bargain bin. And what I mean by that is, I know they spend lots of money on players, like, for example, 25 million on Lucas Moura, but Lucas Moura is probably like in this market, like a 40, 45 million pound player. It's just that PSG was selling him because they need to get rid of guys to reach FFP. So what would you say Spurs have to do? What are Spurs' priorities this summer if they are to take this, inverted commas, like, step to the next level, each of you?
I think they need a big name player. For me, their signings have all been underwhelming. They've not been signings that you'd expect to break into the first team at all. They've almost been signings to fill the FA Cup or the League Cup or the games against the smaller teams in the Premier League to come off the bench. I think for me, they need to have somebody who's gonna bring competition back. I mean, Dele Alli's started almost every game this season and has been quite poor for a lot of it. He's had no one to challenge him for that position.
He's had flashes, hasn't he? But it's not been a dominant season like he had last year.
I actually think they need more players like Dele Alli, who will look quite rotten for large periods of a game, but then will turn up. Dele Alli is one of their few big game players. A lot of them actually shrink in that situation. I can't remember the last time Lamella had a decent game in a really big game. And yeah. You might almost say they need somebody, a little bit of creative disruption. this summer. They need to sign a player who, when things are going badly for them, will grab them by the scruff of the neck, but may, you know, run the risk of disrupting that really pleasant, you know, rose-scented dressing room harmony that they've got. I mean, just to pick a name off the top of my head, somebody of the ilk of an Arnautovic, somebody who can seize a game, but will also give his teammates a kick up the arse.
Well, so one that they've been chasing for last couple of years and indeed have bid for was Wilfried Zaha. And one of my problems I have with Spurs occasionally is that when they're coming forward against teams who are just willing to sit deep, sometimes they just lack a guy who can just beat a man, you know? Yeah. So, sometimes, like, basically everyone's matched up. The defence is, like, zonally laid out. You're stripped across the field. You just need someone who can beat one or two men, and it completely changes the game, and you force things to happen, and then that happens. Someone has to make, someone has to make a covering run, and then Christian Eriksen suddenly free on the edge of the box.
Right, that's Walker could do that, and Trippier can't, and Aurier can't really. And I think somebody who can beat a man on the outside,
yeah,
which then stretches the game.
And Spurs basically will never spend the amount of money they would need to buy a Wilfried Zaha, because Crystal Palace would ask too much money. He's got too long left in his contract, and he's already earning more than a lot of the top Spurs players.
And he loves Croydon. He loves Croydon.
He does. I mean, you know, he came out and said it the other day. I don't really want to leave. It's my hometown club, etc. He's already had that bad experience of leaving. I think if a Champions League club came in with loads of money, I mean loads of money, that Palace would have to consider it. But I don't think Tottenham are ever going to be that club. I don't think that's... This is the whole point. This is that they never shop from that sort of bin. They always shop from the bin below it. And Miguel did a story last week, said that Spurs are going to have about 120 million to upgrade the squad this summer. They're also going to sell Toby. So that might be up to, say, 150.
But they're looking at
like Jay Rodriguez, looking at Johnny Evans. I think Johnny Evans might be good value, but Jay Rodriguez might not be the player you want, the game-breaking talent we're talking about.
Johnny Evans might not be the worst shout, actually.
He's only £3 million.
Yeah.
I think for that money, you don't get much in the Premier League. So I think it's absolutely essential.
You want to play him in games where, like, for example, Real Madrid or Borussia Dortmund in the Champions League, where you do kind of have to sit 10, 15 yards deeper. And you do need someone who can marshal a defence and win his headers. Not a bad shout.
He's very experienced. He's probably, you're talking about a guy who's probably played like 50 Champions League games in his career already.
I mean, there are shades of Ryan Nelson here as well, where the big January, was it January 2012, the big transfer window when Harry Redknapp really had a chance to push for the title, and in came Luis Saha and Ryan Nelson and maybe Stephen Pienaar.
I was actually watching the other day, completely unrelated, when Luis Saha was playing for Fulham and was really, really good. And some of his finishes, you kind of forget how good he was, because he went on to Man United and kind of had a bit of a meh.
He was all right.
Sort of time. Exactly. He was always the backup. But when he was at Fulham and he was on fire, he was like pretty much unstoppable. He was so fast. Great movement.
Two-footed.
Yeah. Just slid. He kind of just slid between the fullback and the centre-back, would like chip the keeper from 25 yards, no worries. But that's the end
of
his saga.
That was one of the great sliding doors transfer windows, though. I mean, if Tottenham had invested and bought, I can't remember who they were linked with that January, but if they'd kicked on and maybe finished top two or three, who knows where they'd be now? Well, Harry Redknapp would be in his 11th season.
I don't think he would have taken the Real Madrid job by now. But Manchester United versus Chelsea, Johnny, just a final word on the actual FA Cup final. I mean, we'll probably preview it in depth before the actual final, I would suggest. But
Conte's got a big issue with knockout football. He's not won a cup, I don't think. Lost last season in the final when they were big favourites. It was interesting yesterday in his press conference that he said we're not favourites this time, and I don't think they are. I think Mourinho's Manchester United in a big May final, you always have to back them. They will come up with a bespoke plan. They will defend with six behind the ball. With a back line of six, and Eden Hazard will get the shit kicked out of him.
Yeah, do we feel like Conte's team has been... So far, it's felt like they're going out with a whimper. Now, they got kind of the easy semi playing against a team that's probably about to get relegated and won it. So I'm sure they'd argue differently. But because it feels like this is tailing off, this old Chelsea experience for Conte, if they lose this, it really does, it is a kind of just a pathetic end to his reign, which I think has been quite interesting. And actually, you know, what he did last year, I think, was an incredible success.
Yeah, it's they're a shadow of their selves from last year. I think the second the whole Diego Costa thing kicked off, that was, in hindsight, the beginning of the end for him. They lost their main striker, the guy who bullied people, for lack of a better word. He showed them that, you know, we're a team to be messed with, and they didn't. They just don't have that. They don't have that with Morata.
Morata is the embodiment of too nice, almost.
And Hazard, he's gone off the boil far too much this season. You saw on Sunday when he wants to play, he was really, really good yesterday.
Yeah. But also, he does need somebody. He does need people around him to make the runs and to provide him with service, and also to almost take the pressure off him a little bit. I think there are times when he's had to carry that side, and you know, hasn't quite been able to do it.
They just need, you know, they're going to have to, obviously with a new manager, probably going to have to retool. I thought Luis Enrique was a good fit for there, but I think it was Matt Law for the Telegraph reported this week that Chelsea are considering going in a new direction with all this. They've been linked with a lot of names. They certainly spoke to the agent of Leonardo Jardim, and they've got Sarri was one of the names being linked. Sarri would be really interesting because Abramovich has always wanted that beautiful football. Luis Enrique, obviously immense success with Barcelona, but more questionable spells with Roma. Celta Vigo was, a qualified success. Those sorts of guys they've been linked with. Allegri as well. But maybe it's Matt Law's report was that they're looking at finding a younger guy, a project, and it's like, would you kind of... It felt like they were almost testing the water. Like, would you accept a year without a trophy, maybe a year, 2 years like Klopp, to find your feet, to get a real project going, like a Pochettino-style thing with Spurs? And it would be interesting, of course, if Chelsea did that. I don't know who they're thinking of. If you're looking at Nagelsmann or Domenico Tedesco, one of these German guys, and being like, okay, that's the guy. But I'm interested to see what direction Chelsea go in, and that may obviously now be affected by the biggest news on Friday, which was Arsene Wenger announcing pretty clearly against his will that he wants to leave. Johnny, what
hang
was your...
Hang on. Go on. What?
Yeah, no. You,
what?
You, well, I should say,
it was a
little peek behind
the
curtain.
I was off for the weekend. What?
Johnny was on holiday and still wrote me a piece on Wenger. For which I'm very thankful. Your piece,
I wrote it for the fans, really.
Yeah, no, of course. don't we all? Your piece
wrote against your will.
More about the fact that it was someone who was endlessly committed to the belief that football could be beautiful, and that was something that lingered, well, not lingered. It was a key pillar throughout his reign of 22 years. When he had success and when he didn't have success, because a lot of the stuff written about him over the last 3-4 days has been kind of clearly defining the two eras. The era of Wenger was good and the era of Wenger was not so good. But he was a guy that ultimately stuck to the idea that he thinks football can be an art form.
Yeah. I mean, I think there was a famous, very, very famous quote where he said that my aim is to do, if you do something so well, to accomplish something so brilliantly that it turned into art, which is a sentence that I often think of when we're recording this podcast. I wonder if we talk about the two eras of Wenger, whether there are actually three. There was obviously the amazing era of success between 96 and 2004. And then comes the kind of the consolidation bit where they genuinely have their hands tied financially because of the stadium. From about last 5 years, 2012, 2013 onwards, the stadium is pretty much paid off. They are financial heavyweights. They've got massive cash reserves, abominable cash reserves, and the decline continues. So I wonder whether it's actually worth thinking about the Wenger era in those terms rather than simply the boom and bust.
I think there are two things that kind of struck me about this, and fortunately, I wasn't pressed into action to actually writing something myself on Friday because you jumped into action. We had Miguel writing however many pieces he wrote and Jack and stuff. And we had the news story that there was interest in Luis Enrique and there's been some contact there. The interesting thing for me is kind of twofold. One, Arsene Wenger leaving has kind of come down to fan power in the end. And people, you know, people often say, you know, the only way they'll understand is if you hit them in the pocket, hit them where it hurts, you start kind of not going to the games and stuff. And this season, after years of Wenger out, really, that is what had happened. And we knew the Americans would be most acceptable to this because they don't seem to care about anything else, Kroenke and his son. And people did start not going to games and boycotting games. And then what we saw, the kind of, I was really surprised by his backlash yesterday, saying kind of blaming the fans for this. And what I thought was going to be a really sort of a much more harmonious final month or so in charge and people getting behind him and the team, and they might have a better chance against Atletico, who are a clearly superior football team, but if they've got a bit more motivation because it's the end of Wenger. I think I've read that completely wrong. It feels like there's it's almost like an acrimonious sort of split now, which I really thought they would get over just for the sake of the previous 22 years.
Well, Wenger was sacked. Let's put this in quite stark terms. He was told, you're going in the summer. You can be sacked now or you can be sacked later. You can put your own spin on it, but you're not staying. And if somebody tells you you're not staying, what's that? That's being sacked, isn't it? But I think that the Arsenal board have quite cleverly managed to dodge the sort of the negative influence of sacking Arsene Wenger after 22 years. They've said, you can go on your own terms, and there isn't that sort of poisonous feeling. Now, over the next few weeks, because Wenger clearly does have stuff that he wants to get on his chest.
Wow, yeah, no, that's what I mean.
That may well, you know, that strategy may well backfire on them. But I think it's the first thing we have to do is call it what it is. I think I wrote on Twitter last night, if you're pushed into going before you're pushed, have you really gone before you're pushed?
The philosophical questions we're all asking, Jack. Do you think fundamentally that Arsenal have done the right thing?
Yeah, I mean, they had to, because you just see from his press conference yesterday, he still believes he's the right man and he will hold on to that job till the day he died if it was up to him. He believes that no one can do a better job than he can. He believes he's performing, and Arsenal performing to their maximum at the moment, and they can't improve on what he's doing, and only he can improve on what he's doing. And I think it's that level of stubbornness which ultimately has just forced Arsenal's hand. They had to do it because he was not going to do the honourable thing. So they just had to cut the cord.
I'm not an Arsenal fan, but I was a Wenger loyalist all the way through. I mean, I would have loved to have seen him just go on and on and on and die in the job and, you know, be sort of preserved in formaldehyde like Lenin and Stalin in a mausoleum, maybe just like prop him up in the dugout in his massive big coat. I would have loved to have seen that happen. But as I say, I'm not an Arsenal fan, and it's not really my call to make, and it's not really our call to make. It's for the last two or three years, it wasn't the fact that Arsenal were bad. It was that they were boring. They were spectacularly, stupefyingly, predictably dull.
Well, that's the key word, I think, predictable. Yeah. I think you always knew what was coming. Like every turn of the farce, it was very much a foreseeable, like, embarrassment, you know?
Even 2012, 2013, when Wenger was responding to their kind of their definite deficit in central defence and central midfield by just buying more and more attacking midfielders. There was a kind of, could this work? He was trying to recreate what he had. Now it's sort of that formula has been shown to have not worked, and as a club, as a business that relies as much on its ability to provide advertising space for other companies as for its own success, if you don't have the storyline, if you don't have the narrative, if you're not engaging people, then it's really hard from a commercial level to sustain that.
Well, and the commercial thing absolutely has to play part here, because Arsenal, the thing that Wenger has done is you remember the club that he took over was a club that, you know, they played at Highbury, and it was not amateurish, but the players were out boozing after training every day. You know, it's a completely different world, and that's been covered extensively. What he leaves behind is one of the biggest clubs in the world, with a state-of-the-art huge stadium, with an okay squad, granted that needs some work, incredible cash reserves, as you've commented on, Johnny. And it was 2 days before this was announced. They were talking about FIFA potentially ditching the Confederations Cup and kind of expanding the Club World Cup. And that fundamentally is a realization that, you know what? People care about club football more than international football. It's something we've talked about on here quite a few times. Now, if you imagine a Club World Cup in the summer, 32 of the biggest teams in the world, and they convene in, let's be honest, probably Azerbaijan or somewhere, some forlorn regime that's paid loads of money to FIFA to hold the tournament in completely ludicrous circumstances.
Who won't be sponsoring this podcast?
Yes, no, none of the above. They're playing in Yemen or wherever, and you've got 32 teams, and the idea was there are 18 teams that kind of got their entry like guaranteed, and one of those was Arsenal. Now, Arsenal are going to finish sixth, possibly seventh in the Premier League this year. But this is what Arsenal have become. Arsenal are a massive club, as we know, looking at just like web traffic, for example. Arsenal are one of the top three clubs for us in the world. And Arsenal were the same at previous places I've worked. And they've got an enormous fan base in India, in Nigeria, like all around the world. People know Arsenal as a club that played good football and a club that's had success, you know, because there are people who say anything between 21 and 40 now who have grown up with the Invincibles, and yeah, they've grown up with even the team before that, like the kind of the Dixon Adams sort of era.
They were the most successful team when the internet was coming of age.
Yeah, and that's huge. And that, it's an enormous, I think that's probably the most salient point, is that that helped spread them around the world, basically. And Arsenal have done a great job of making the most of that, and they've become this huge global entity. And Arsene Wenger has played a bigger part in that, I think, than anyone else. Are we going to say David Dean?
I think he turned them into a giant. And when he took over, I think when he took over in 96, they were occasionally a mid-table club, occasionally a team that challenged for the title, but they'd spent quite a few seasons being, you know, 8th, 9th, 13th, that sort of size.
And when you create this corporate behemoth, when you create this huge, all-powerful thing, which is more of a business perhaps than a sports team at times, what happens is you become susceptible to the money men. And that's why when the fans started staying away from games, that was ultimately the thing that did for him. Nothing else on the pitch, nothing else that's happened before, missing out the Champions League, whatever. It was the fact that the people start staying away from games. Now, I think it's reassuring in many ways that fan power can still have that effect in this time, because we live in such an insulated sort of corporate football world now that you almost think that there'd be a never-ending supply of people willing to come to the games still, tourists or whoever. But it's a slight reassurance that fans still do have that power in the 21st century. It's a shame that it's Arsene Wenger, who is a wonderful man, I think, and I think he's been great, obviously, for the league and stuff. It's a shame for him that he's having to leave against his will, but that's how these things work sometimes.
I have Arsenal supporting friends who, are, for the first time in months, are trying to get tickets for the Burnley game, yeah, and saying, can you get us tickets? You're a sports journalist. Can you get us tickets for the Burnley game?
Not how it works, guys.
That's not how it works.
I was talking to an Arsenal fan about 2 weeks ago who said he wouldn't pay for another ticket until Wenger's gone. Which made me wonder, does it now count now that, like, would you now go to one of the farewell games? Which I think would be what most fans would want to do. They still got the Atletico Madrid game, which I guess we should preview. Atletico Madrid are a miles better team than Arsenal. We should put that out there. Jan Oblak did admit that they're kind of tired. Do you think they've got a better chance of progressing because of this Wenger news?
I'm not convinced. I think, if you look against West Ham, for large parts of that game, they weren't brilliant. They were pretty average. They're pretty stale. They came on strong in the last 20 minutes and scored three more goals. But there wasn't the reaction that people were expecting for Wenger. There was no ovation from the players. There wasn't like a, we must win this for him. It didn't feel like a different Arsenal, and I'm not convinced it will again on Thursday.
First leg being at the Emirates, I think, makes a big difference. I think if the second leg had been at the Emirates, they'd been playing the second leg at home, and maybe they'd they were two goals down and scored with 20 minutes to go, then that surge of sentiment, that Wenger-driven kind of emotion might be enough to get them over the line. I think playing the second leg in Madrid almost negates that.
Well, the thing with Atletico is you don't want to be in a position where you're having to chase the game and have to score goals against them, because they're the best defensive team in Europe over the last 4 or 5 years without any question of a doubt. And they've got Griezmann on the counter-attack and Koke and Saul and all the talent they have. Do I see a situation where they could catch Atletico out and nick a goal and a 1-1 draw? Because what Atletico don't tend to do is score lots. They win a lot of games 1-0 and 2-1 and whatever. So if they could maybe like a 1-1 draw from the first leg,
the tie will be alive going into the last half an hour. Pretty much whatever happens, the tie will be alive. And in many ways, that's what Atletico want. And they're sort of the Djokovic of football. They want it to go long and deep, mm-hmm. and they want to be able to grind you down and say, like, what have you got? Because we've got...
Things suddenly getting very, very hot in here. but, I mean, they're fundamentally, Atletico, an incredibly tough team to play against because they're so hard to break down, so hard to score against. And Arsenal, traditionally, you would say, are one of these great attacking teams. But are they still that great attacking team? I mean, they've got good attacking players. You've got Ozil, who can create something, and Lacazette, Aubameyang, guys who are notionally top strikers. But do we really think, like, what percentage chance would you give Arsenal getting through to the final here?
35-40.
I'd have it around 22.5%. That would be mine. And we're not going to preview RB Salzburg against, or is it Salzburg or Leipzig? One of them against Marseille, because that's the other semi-final. I think the winner of Arsenal Atletico should go on and win the whole thing. For Atletico, it wouldn't mean much, except it's just another trophy. For Arsenal, obviously, it would mean the world, because the new Champions manager League. Could come in and have the Champions League. Just a word from either of you, not who you expect, but who would you like to take over at Arsenal?
I think they should go for Conte. I think if Conte leaves Chelsea and they don't put a clause in that he can go to another Premier League team, that is who I would like to see at Arsenal.
It's not a bad shout.
Wenger's out of work in the summer.
Hire him as sporting director.
Absolute banter. Absolute banter if they unveil their new manager and it's Wenger.
If you go on, you must have a name.
Nagelsmann.
Eddie
Howe or Nagelsmann. I think Howe has been kind of unfairly sidelined from the conversation because he's had his like little trendy moment in the sun and now he's just a kind of very good young English manager in the Premier League. But if they're looking for somebody who will change the way that they think and who has a fresh approach to the game in the same way that Wenger did, then you're looking at somebody young. And I think Nagelsmann and Howe are probably the two near the top of my list.
Nagelsmann would be interesting. I mean, it would be a leap of faith for them to do that. I don't know how risk averse, because there's been this like sea change inside the club with these new people being hired. The guy from Barcelona that's arrived, Sven Mislintat, who's there, and Josh Kroenke taking a bigger role on. I don't know personally these. I don't know how they operate, so I don't know how risk averse they are. But
American owners do tend to be.
But then again, what Stan Kroenke did with his NFL team was hire the youngest head coach of all time, 31 years old, Sean McVay, and he took the team from being the worst team in the league to being a playoff team within one season. So it's not out of the realm of possibilities. They also, I think, their NHL team, Colorado Avalanche, I think they did that with Joe Sakic as well, but I don't know enough about NHL to say that for sure. We'll just finally look ahead to the Champions League semi-finals this week. I really struggle to... It is not Juventus. It's Bayern Munich versus Real Madrid. You're going to both legs of this, correct?
Yes, yeah.
What are you most looking forward to in this one?
I'm looking forward to watching the second leg of Roma against Liverpool in a bar in Madrid.
Yeah?
I really want to see... I mean, Roma against Liverpool is probably... It's the standout semi, isn't it? Bayern and Real Madrid have played...
So many times.
And I know I should be trying to drum up a little bit more excitement about this thing, because I'm going to both legs. And I've not been to Allianz before, and I'm really kind of...
I think it might be the best football stadium in the world.
I've heard this, but I also heard from James Gearbear at the Times yesterday that it takes about 2 hours to find a press entrance. Have you been?
I went to Bayern Atletico the semi. I did the one when Atletico played Real Madrid in Milan. I did 3 of the 4 semi-final legs, including both of Bayern Atletico, and it was Pep Guardiola's Atletico against Diego Simeone's Atletico. Pep Guardiola's Bayern against Diego Simeone's Atletico, which was, like, as you'd expect, belting football against a brick wall of humans. I thought the Allianz for a new stadium. I mean, I'm a massive stadium geek, so you've set me off here. One, looks brilliant from the outside.
Important.
Yeah. Two,
Instagrammable.
Looks great on the inside. Retains a brilliant atmosphere, like really good atmosphere. 4, press facilities, excellent. They've got beer on tap after the game. They've got a carvery where this guy's slicing like roast beef off for you and stuff. I'm talking high grade vegetables, like everything. So like,
fantastic chassis and legs all the way up to there. I mean, that was kind of where you were going there.
No. The press conference room is like an auditorium. So it's like, you got facilities, tick. Looks great, tick. Atmosphere's excellent. Wi-Fi works. Like, it had everything you'd want from a game. Easy to get to on the U-Bahn, I think it's called. I just loved it. I thought, it's the best modern stadium I've been to for sure. I mean, like, you've got a discount, like, places like the Bombonera, because it's great for a different reason. But the Allianz might be the best
that,
stadium.
That's Buenos Aires.
That's Boca, yeah. And the Mestalla at Valencia is great, but for a different reason. It's just so steep, and it's like a proper football ground. This is one of the few modern ones that captures still, you know, a great atmosphere. And I don't know, like, it keeps the fans really on top of the pitch as well, which is important, rather than Wembley, where they're all spaced out and about 400 yards back.
Well, I've been told to get there about 3 or 4 hours early.
I think you'll be right. But, I mean, if you're hungry, then certainly. Oh, in the metro station there, brilliant bratwursts in the... So get one of those, but only one of those. I had 2, and you'll fill yourself up.
I'll just FaceTime you when I get there. You can give me instructions.
I'll also give you the Madrid restaurant recommendations. But this game, Bayern Munich, there's a weird thing where the Spanish kind of fear German teams, because German teams tend to have this ruthless efficiency, which really worries Spanish people, who are the ruthlessly most inefficient people on the planet. And Bayern Munich and Real Madrid obviously have a huge history. But I do have a little twang that I think your Pinkers and co could shock Real Madrid. I don't think this Real Madrid team are that good. I don't think this Bayern team, having seen them in Seville, are that good. But it's just a feeling that Yup's done it before in this kind of same situation. I think he might do it again.
I think we've seen quite a lot of frailties from Real so far this season. I think Bayern are a little bit better than people think they are, and they've certainly shown that again in the Bundesliga. I think what has troubled Real this season is pace. I mean, their defence just isn't as quick as it used to be, and that's one thing that Bayern do have and have had for the last few years.
Kingsley Coman, Douglas Costa.
Yeah.
I think you have to go with those two ahead of Robin and Ribery.
Yeah.
For this one. It's the little channel between Sergio Ramos and Marcelo has been their weakness for the last 2-3 years now. You just need basically a really good right attacker to take it on. And I think someone like Douglas Costa or Kingsley Coman, whoever you want to use in that slot.
Costa at Juve, right?
Who am I thinking of then? Who's the Bayern guy?
Coman.
I'm just gonna have to Google this, because I know exactly who I'm thinking of. I can see his bloody face. You, Jack, went to Rome last week.
I did.
And you spoke to Kevin Strootman.
I did. Yeah. Very interesting man. Obviously, Kevin Strootman, known to many a Manchester United fan as being linked with them ruthlessly for about 3 or 4 years.
The Nico Gaetan of his age.
Exactly.
And what did he have to say on that?
Basically, yeah, he talked about whether there was actually any contact, because obviously he was one of the many players that Moyes tried to bring in to rejuvenate that midfield, and also Louis van Gaal looked at him as well, having had him at Holland. But insisted there was never any contact between them. And he's mainly just looking forward to repaying the loyalty shown by him, shown to him by Roma after his horrific knee injury. He spoke really well on that, talked about how he would never play football again, never complete 90 minutes again. And just that long struggle back to 2 years out with three knee injuries, two knee surgeries. To come back from that and now to be playing in a Champions League semi-final is just quite a magnificent achievement.
An interesting angle to this, obviously, is Mo Salah last night crowned PFA Player of the Year. Roma sold him last year, presumably. I think they undersold him slightly now for, what was it, 40 million euros, whatever. But they know him best. You know, they've played with him in training every day. They've played with him on the team, and they know his strengths and weaknesses. What did he say about what they're going to do to Mo?
Normally, Strootman is actually deployed in the sort of man-marking role, and he said that Roma have prepared a special plan for Salah. He actually was pretty interesting in the fact that if anyone's seen Salah over the past couple of years in Italy, they would see that he was quite an inefficient striker. He missed a lot of chances, very wasteful. Someone that you wouldn't recognise as the Liverpool striker this season. And Strootman actually alluded to that, how it was almost frustrating that he missed so many one-on-ones with the goalkeeper. And he actually said that the main difference now is that this guy's got a knockable confidence. He misses and just knows he's going to score the next. Whereas when he was at Roma, he didn't have that belief that he was going to score every chance.
No, he was quite wasteful in that the Real Madrid Champions League tie when he went through that hole we were talking about between Marcelo and Sergio Ramos. Went through it about 20 times in that over two legs and just couldn't score. Just didn't have it in him. I just Googled, by the way, Douglas Costa plays for Juventus on loan from Bayern Munich. I've reassessed my opinion. I'm going to say put Thomas Müller in there, just ghosting around in that little gap. And that's where you're going to try and find something. But we think Liverpool, going back to Liverpool, Roma, sorry. Go on.
Yeah, no, one of my favourite bits of the interview was when Strootman said that we're gonna sort it out with Italian defending, and this I imagine is the Italian
a secret code. Who knows what that could mean?
That kept him so quiet in Serie A over the last two or three seasons. That I think, you know, they've got a real job there, and I think the way to stop Salah is to stop him getting the ball.
Yes,
and whether that means they need to be a little bit, you know, a little bit more efficient than Liverpool in midfield and stop him getting the service. That's probably the most efficient way of, because once he's got the ball, the form he's in, it's really tough.
Who do we think is going to be? I think there are ways to play against Liverpool. Obviously, one of the things that's notable about them is how much they win the ball high up, especially Firmino. I think he's got this weird stat that he's had some of the most tackles or something in the league this year. And so Roma need to be careful playing the ball out from the back. And sometimes, in the same way that Klopp found this with Guardiola, I think you can expose Klopp's teams by the kind of long diagonals and getting in behind. I guess Edin Dzeko, who is it? Someone pointed out recently, I think it was Jacob Steinberg in The Guardian did a piece on how Edin Dzeko is kind of the flag bearer for players who leave the Premier League in terms of becoming a real success. He's done a great job at Roma. Did Strootman say anything else about kind of what he thinks is a way they can take Liverpool on?
He spoke quite highly of their attack, obviously, as you'd expect him to. So I said, so what do you think? Is their defence then where you would call a weakness? And, you know, he's like, no, that's not what I'm saying. Yeah. They're not weak in defence. I think for them, it's getting the first goal at Anfield and really killing off the crowd and just not allowing the crowd an opportunity to get behind Liverpool. And once they do that, I think almost just making Liverpool look boring, that is their best way of beating them.
Earlier in the season, the way that teams would get at Liverpool was, like you say, long diagonal balls, get in behind the fullback, because Robertson and
Alexander-Arnold
or Gomez push high and you get in the space behind and you get the crosses in. The trouble is that over the last few weeks, they've become so much better with dealing with crosses. Van Dijk has had this really transformative effect on how they defend their penalty box, quite apart from all the other stuff that he's brought. Lovren seems to have—he's 20-25% better as a player since Van Dijk has arrived next to him. And so, the ways that you would get at Liverpool earlier in the season aren't necessarily going to be as successful now, because as we see that they've tightened up so much in their own 18-yard box.
It's hard to counteract someone like Dzeko, because he just has this. In the same way, it's very difficult to play against pure speed. If you come up against a guy who's what, 6'7" or whatever he is. It's very.
He's not 6'7", is he?
He's massive. He's enormous.
He's large. I mean, I suspect he. You know, you wouldn't want to get on the. You wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of him in the Sainsbury's self checkout area. But
he, I'm gonna look this up. I reckon he's min 6'6".
6'6".
Oh, 1.93 meters, 6'5".
That's 6'4".
About 6'4". Big guy. We've seen Lovren get exposed on those kind of. He loses a man behind him quite a lot. Mm-hmm. Alexander Arnold and Robertson obviously wouldn't have the height to deal with far post headers like that. So that's an obvious way of trying to get them. But I think that Roma are really going to need to compete in midfield. I think the Liverpool midfield has been kind of underrated in the way that, especially that Man City game where they had, it was the three English lads in there. It was Milner, Oxlade-Chamberlain and Henderson. Roma are really going to need to stop what they do, which is quickly recycle the ball and get it forward to one of those three. I think Roma do have the players, and I think Strootman is going to be a key part of that, because he has to basically shield that back four, and then it's his distribution's got to be perfect, because Firmino is going to be on Strootman, I'd guess, virtually from the get-go. But fundamentally, I think this feels like a very explosive Champions League tie, whereas the one you're going to feels more like
regal. Like, yes. it's going to be...
Yeah. Like everyone's wearing their finest suits, so they couldn't possibly get it messy. Whereas Liverpool-Roma, everyone's wearing, like, fluorescent jackets.
Bibs.
And probably going to need helmets and goggles as well. Anything else you'd like to say about the Champions League semi-finals before we wrap things up?
No, I'm looking forward to... I think the atmosphere at Liverpool is going to be great, but I also think the atmosphere at Roma is going to be on par with it. I think in for two spectacular legs.
I just want to know. So when I come out of Munich Airport,
yeah, we'll work this out. I'll give you my best restaurant in Madrid, where you should definitely have dinner. It's a delight, and the food's right up your street as well.
What is it? I mean, let's share it with our listeners.
Gastromaquia in Chueca, which is the gay district, but also like the best district for bars and restaurants, on a street called Calle Pelayo, and it's just kind of more like 21st century reimagined tapas sort of stuff. A lot of good kind of raw bits. They also just do great seafood. Madrid gets the best seafood in Spain because it's the first stuff they fly in. They kind of get it on the plane straight in the morning, then you can have it by 9 a.m. So
better than San Sebastian.
No. They reassure me that it's absolutely the best in.
Do you remember where we went to dinner in Madrid when you were out living in Madrid? We went to Maison Chistu.
Oh, Maison Chistu is Gareth Bale's favorite restaurant.
Gareth Bale's favorite restaurant. His favorite dish. Egg and chips.
Ham, egg and chips, technically.
Ham, yeah. Egg and chips. He's getting...
That place is good. It's just expensive. They do that steak where it comes out on the hot clay plate and you cook it yourself. It's like, why am I paying a lot of money to cook my own meal?
Yeah. No, it is expensive. And I think you're paying a little bit of a premium for having loads of smiling photos with the owner with Real Madrid players on the window.
Well, they do say it's the best ham in Madrid, the jamón. But that is only proof that we've gone so far off topic that it's time to finish up. May I thank the pride of Wales, Jack Austin, as ever, for coming in, for sharing his experience with the Stroot, as he now calls him. Weird, it's like they're friends.
Strooty fruity.
Never say that again. Johnny, thank you for coming in.
Yeah, thank you.
Look forward to this week. I look forward to seeing what you discover on your travels, and I guess we'll be back with you next week.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information, application and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.